to those looking to live outside the box of religious performance and inside the love of an awesome Father, this is the God Journey. Well, I'm sorry if I frustrated you on the last podcast. I know I was going to talk a little more about the writing process I'm involved in. And many of you say, well, he didn't actually get back to that. Well, I actually was going to do it now. See, I'm doing this back to back from the one I just did because, as I'm telling you, I'm getting ready to get on this flight and head off to Israel. So by the time you hear this, we'll be about at least 4 or 5 days into our Israel trip or so. And there won't be a podcast the next week because I'm not around. And I'm not taping three of these before I go, not alone, not in this office, not with just me because, whoa. Someday, I hope we have a co-host again that has a lot more fun talking about these things with other people, but at least it allows us to stay, as some people write me, allows you to stay on topic a little better, because, yeah, with Brad and I, we were shooting all over the mountain. We were just a barrage of things that maybe some things hit, maybe others didn't, but so I did say I'd come back and talk about that, and I really meant now, so sorry if you had to wait a week going, when did he talk about that? Let me just tell you where I'm at a little bit in the process. I know many of you are writing, many of you are praying for this book, and I'm as excited as I can be about it. But it's been more work than I thought it would be. I thought it would write easier, and it's not writing easily. But I don't mind the work of writing. I actually love trying to get these thoughts into a framework that people are going to want to engage. So I'm well into the process, and I'm now within. Oh gosh, I probably got 78% of it done at this point. I know that sounds pretty precise, but I've got 3 chapters left, and they're some of the easier chapters. They're some of the cleanup chapters. I'm working on the one right now, the 4th from the end. It's the most exciting. It's the pinnacle of the whole book. It's called, for those of you who want to know the title, it's called Unity Without Conformity. And it kind of is the culmination of the whole thing. How could we have unity with conformity? Seriously, if I make you do, I'm the leader of something, and I make you do what I want, or you just follow me because, you know, Wayne's the author you like, and so your life is, I'm buying into everything Wayne does. Is that unity? And the answer is no, it's not. Because it's not coming from the reality of all of our lives engaged in Jesus. Jesus talked about unity. May they be one, Father, as we are one. May they be in you and you in them. He's really saying our unity with each other is derived from each of our unity with him. So my engaging him, letting him shape me. Unity is not uniformity. Unity is often harmony. Unity is often expressed. There's something of the multifacetedness. I don't want to get into that chapter because that's just, but to me, this is the pinnacle where people come into real heartfelt agreement, even have disagreements about things, but hold those lightly, because where we take certainty or a greater measure of certainty is when I know a bunch of folks on a Jesus journey who hold a similar reality in their heart. That reality becomes more real to me, if that makes sense. So the power of heartfelt agreement, which conformity can't begin. Well, I've told you what to believe, what to do, how to practice, what to sing, when to sing it. I'm working against the reality of heartfelt unity. I opened the chapter with this. Sorry. The best moments in Sarah and my marriage are the things that we wholeheartedly do together. It's not just what I want to do or what Sarah wants to do. There are times for that. There are times when I lay down what I'd prefer because I want to bless Sarah. And there's times when Sarah does that to me. And that's a wonder of love, that love would give up its own to bless the object of the affection. That's a great thing. But there's nothing better. And it can be, a project around the house that we're both wholeheartedly in. Those are rare because Sarah is much more a project around the house guy than I am. But there are times when we're working on something together, exhausted together. There are times when we've got someone engaged with our life that we both love equally, even in their brokenness, and we're involved in their life loving them together. And we come home from times like that going, that's so cool. We love that. The best times are what Sarah and I do with heartfelt agreement. And that's what God's inviting us into. He's inviting us all into that. He's inviting the church to find its unity in the reality of who God is and how God thinks. And none of us see that completely. So when I'm growing in something, and that's what I've loved about the podcast, quite frankly, even if we've had more of that conversation, not now with a co-host, but with other people on the blogs and whatever, we're having a wider conversation as we're trying to sort out what's true. That takes a certain humility of heart. It's not people, and I think the blog postings that mean the least are people, well, this is true. Okay, you know, be part of a conversation. This is how I see it. But I want to know what you see, and I want to find the commonalities that let me see something bigger. I think when you have a heart for truth, you want to be in the widest possible You want to be in the widest possible conversation that you can be in. You don't want to just hang out with people who see things the way you do. You actually want to be with other Jesus followers who may see things a bit differently and interact with them. Because that shapes what I'm seeing. It's the multifaceted wisdom of God invested in the wider community. And so in the dialogues we have, we find out where is our common unity, and that's where unity is. And from that can come agreement. There's agreement in things. Okay, this is probably really close to God's heart because there's a lot of us who come at this very differently who see something similarly. But then there's the power of agreement that comes, and I think this is how the church is meant to impact the world we live in its subversive, loving the world, yes, but also the prayer of agreement where we see something God's doing in the world and we co-labor or collaborate with Him there and with each other. And boy, there's nothing like those moments. It demands a generosity and a humility and a trust in Jesus and a willingness to lay down our need for cash or credit or control. It takes such a growth for us to even begin to experience that kind of agreement. But to me, that's what the church is. That's why the church is not just a collection of Christians. It is a growing relationship among people who are growing to know Him. And in knowing Him, they experience life together. Well, that's more than I meant to go on all that. What I wanted to do was just give you a gift today. If it's that, I know many of you are interested in praying. I'm going to read chapter 2. Now, I've not done any work on chapter 2 in about 4 months. I read chapter 1 here a few weeks ago. I'm going to read chapter 2 to you now. And please understand, same thing I said last time, it's rough. It will not be this way when it's finally published. There's already things I'm seeing that I want to change in it. And part of sharing some of this is to get input of others. I've got about 15 people reading this manuscript with me, and I'm getting their input now. And some of it's incredibly helpful and wonderful, and some of it is a little tedious because everybody goes, well, what about this and what about this? And always with a book, honestly, I could write a 200,000-word book. The target is to write one that's about 60,000. That's about the length of He Loves Me. And it's a length that people can absorb. And you get much more than that, and you're lost in the minutia. So, yeah, I realize there's stuff missing here. There's a whole lot missing. I've got a whole outtakes file. It's huge. And they may recycle in another book someday or whatever. But so if you want to be part of the conversation and blog about this, then go ahead. Remember, this is a setup chapter. This is not everything I'm going to say about this. It's only chapter 2. But here's what it said. The title of it is this: what if Jesus told us everything we needed to know about the church? I've often read through the Gospels wondering what it was that Jesus wanted His disciples to learn during His time on earth. He certainly didn't train the future leaders of the church like we do today. He didn't hold any leadership training conferences, give them a workbook with all they needed to know safely tucked inside, or even start a seminary. He didn't show them how to form and manage a nonprofit organization. He didn't teach them how to hold a service, to lead worship, to exegete an Old Testament passage, or even to write a New Testament one. He didn't craft a doctrine statement so they would know what true believers. He didn't craft a doctrine statement so that we would know true believers from fake ones. He didn't give them a seminar on small group fellowship, organizing a leadership team, or planning an evangelistic outreach. Instead, He simply walked through life, touching people with whom He came into contact, teaching them about His Father's kingdom, and inviting them to live in it with Him. As far as we know, He never was even in a meeting that looked like our Sunday services do today. In fact, He didn't seem to do one thing that would have prepared His disciples to hold a congregational service or organize an international organization to sustain the life of His followers. Of course, just because He didn't do those things doesn't mean we can't. But it should make us wonder about their value, or at least believing the idea that you can't be part of the church if you're not involved with a group of people doing those things. In fact, Jesus didn't talk much about the church at all. He only used the word twice, as the disciples recorded it. once to say he would build it, and another time to help us understand how to deal with someone who is wittingly or unwittingly destroying its life together. Doesn't seem like much, does it? Even at that, what if he told us, and more importantly, showed us, all we needed to know about the church? The assumption, of course, is that he didn't. Many think he left that to Paul, who they think spelled out church life much more clearly. While Paul does talk about the church often and writes to the church in various localities to address problems in or to answer questions about their life together, Paul didn't seem to do any more of those things we identify with church today than Jesus did. We never see him in a Sunday service with a worship team or a Bible lecturer. He certainly would never have conceived of multiple churches in the same city having different names, different doctrines, and different worship styles. They didn't have seminaries to prepare leaders, ruling boards to make decisions, or even a building to gather in other than their own homes. For us to quote scriptures and apply them as justification for whatever we might be doing at the Whoville Community Church may miss the point entirely. Our way of organizing congregations in the 21st century has little in scripture to commend it. We spend more time making the scriptures fit our preconceived view of the church rather than deriving our view of the church from the scriptures themselves. Church life today has more to do with institutional identity, meetings, rituals, ethics, procedures, and doctrines than demonstrating what a community of godly love looks like. From that foundation, it is difficult to find our way into the reality of Christ's church, which is replete with authenticity, compassion, freedom, and life. Maybe he didn't talk so much about the church because it was not the means to his end. What if he knew it was simply the fruit of his working and that it naturally takes shape as people come to know him and learn to follow him? If so, then Jesus really did tell us everything we needed to know about the church by not talking about it. His entire ministry was focused on a kingdom that he was inaugurating in the world. Like the beachhead at Normandy, he invaded this broken world to insert the life of God into human history. He embodied that kingdom, spoke about it in parables, and invited people to embrace that kingdom by embracing him. Matthew, Mark, and Luke used the term kingdom over 100 times in their recollection of Jesus and what was important to him. The terminology switches in John. He uses the term kingdom sparingly, but uses the words life and eternal life to talk about the same reality. For John, eternal life didn't just describe life after death, but the quality of God's life that we can experience now by entering into an affection-based relationship with Jesus, his Father, and the Spirit he would soon send. Jesus opened the door to our participation in the divine community in the midst of this broken creation. The Jews of the first century made the mistake of thinking that the kingdom of the Messiah would be a political kingdom that would overthrow Rome and lead to a time of peace and prosperity. Disillusioned when Jesus indicated no passion to do so, they rejected him. They sought a physical kingdom and couldn't see the more powerful kingdom that was making its way into a world through Jesus himself. Proclaiming freedom, offering forgiveness, healing the sick, loving the outcast, and making his home among fallen humanity were signs that the kingdom had already come. Rather than shape our political world, it would first transform a new race of men and women to live inside the reality of God in the chaos of a fallen planet. By dancing to a different tune than the self-preferring strains of the world, they would reveal God's power to a world desperately in need of it. But Christianity made the same mistake the first century Jewish leaders did, by thinking of it as a political reality in the old creation. Confused that the kingdom didn't materialize the way they hoped, they didn't recognize Jesus as Messiah. While Christianity recognized him as the Messiah, it also expected a political fix. Christians have taken two off-traveled roads here, either by trying to employ the political and economic powers of the old creation to conform society to their liking, or by simply waiting until the end of the age when Jesus subdues all powers. They still see the kingdom in a material sense and frame their view of church that way as well, missing the true nature of both the kingdom and the church. The realm of Jesus' kingdom lies in the human heart as it comes alive in the new creation. Its currency is not political or economic power, but lives transformed by love, embracing a different set of priorities and a different mission in the world. So whatever Jesus did or didn't say to his disciples about the church, he did teach them the power of love and challenge them to share as freely with the world that love they had received from him. The life of the kingdom is discovered inside the Father's affection. The best presentation of the gospel I ever heard came out of the mouth of an atheist who hated Christians. That was his description of himself in the opening moments of our conversation on a flight from Los Angeles to Pittsburgh. I understood his angst, especially in light of the news magazine article he was reading about one of the heated culture wars that has divided our country. A few moments later, he asked me what I did for a living. I told him that that wasn't an easy question to answer. I haven't had any normal job responsibilities for some time. But on any given day, you can find me writing, traveling, speaking, counseling, or even consulting with public schools on religious liberty issues. So I often answer that question with the answer I gave him. I wander around the planet helping people sort out what Jesus taught. Oh, you do you? He responded with an amused chuckle in his voice. And then he asked me the same question that almost everyone asks me when I introduce myself that way. Do you know what I think Jesus really taught? It used to surprise me when people responded that way, thinking they would want to know what I think. But no, they want to tell me what they think. So here, a self-professed atheist who hates Christians is going to dare to tell me what Jesus really taught. And that's exactly where I wanted this conversation to begin. I would learn a lot by his next few words. I have heard many people tell me what they think Jesus really taught, and they're often wrong, sometimes even hilarious. Not this time. What came out of this man's mouth shocked me. I think Jesus taught us that we have a Father who loves us more than we know, and if we could sort that out, we would know how to treat each other. My jaw dropped open. Held speechless for a moment, it was his turn to look into my amazed countenance. What? He asked. I've never heard it put better, I responded with a shake of my head. Really? Yes, really. I've heard the gospel presented by some of the most famous preachers of our day, and I've read about it in books of those who came before. I have never heard it expressed better by any of them. Where did you get that? I asked him, thinking he must have heard it in an old Sunday school class somewhere. But he shrugged as if he had no idea. Do you know that's exactly what Jesus said? I asked him. He did? Yes, in John 13, a new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. I said, yours is a pretty good version of that statement, so tell me, why don't you believe it? I've never seen it lived, he responded. I don't know that I've ever heard sadder words on an airplane. I have seen it lived, I told him, and he wanted to know more. And for the next hour and a half, I told him about people I know who have been so deeply transformed by the Father's love that they have given themselves away to help others, even to those who had misused or betrayed them. They did not do it because they had to, but because the affection in their heart wouldn't let them do otherwise. In the end, he was deeply moved, and I told him that the gospel had already been planted in his heart. He might want to reconsider what it means to follow Jesus. He assured me he would. The power of Jesus' kind of love is infectious. Who doesn't want to be the object of someone else's affection, especially if they want nothing in return? That's how God's love differs from our lesser human versions of it. We mostly talk of love as the mutual accommodation of self-need. As long as you provide something valuable for me and I provide something valuable for you, we can say we love each other. So our version of love is exploitive at the heart. It's based on what I can get from someone else, and they me. If that mutual benefit is interrupted in some way, or if people ask more than we have to give, then the relationship dies. Jesus defined love not by what we can get, but by what we can give. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. For Jesus, love was a reality, not a commitment. He wasn't committed to us. He genuinely cared enough for us that laying down his life was his only choice in the face of our brokenness. Love is never about what you have to do for someone. It's what we want to do to help someone we deeply care about. That's why love had to begin inside of God. We hadn't a clue what it was until he showed us. It's a relational connection that seeks the good of another above our own. Jesus didn't just talk about it. He demonstrated it in the way he treated people, even sinners, and in his willingness to make the ultimate sacrifice of his life to break the power of destructiveness in the world and free us from our self-preferring nature. His kingdom is not a political system, but a vast network of people, well-loved by the Father and thus loving well in the world. That would be enough, he said, for the whole world to come to know who he is. So what if, when he was walking the countryside with his disciples, talking to a woman at a well, sitting in Zacchaeus' home having lunch, or relaxing in Bethany, He was showing us exactly what his church looks like in this world. She is not a thing man can replicate with the tools of the old creation. She's so much more alive than that. So when Jesus spent time with the Samaritan woman at the well, he was showing us how the church lives. When he told us the story of the Good Samaritan, he was showing us how the church lives. When he embraced Peter before and after his denial, he was showing us how the church lives. So maybe he, in fact, did teach us everything we needed to know about the church. Its teaching is more like a conversation about faith in the stern of a boat after a fierce storm than it is a lecture from a pulpit with a PowerPoint presentation looming in the background. Its gatherings look more like a meal in the upper room than people sitting in rows in theater seats, and its leadership more like one washing feet than sitting in council meetings making decisions for others. One thing is sure. The heritage Jesus left us is a far better reflection of God's reality than the 2,000 years we've spent fighting over doctrine, building cathedrals, fine-tuning our programs and policies, and arrogantly trying to claim our stake of power in the structures of the world. That's the church humanity builds. There is another church, growing in the world that is often unseen, especially by those who think of it as an institution. He didn't have to talk about it much, because he knew the church would emerge as a byproduct of the kingdom. Those who learn to follow him will not be preoccupied with buildings, programs, and prefabricated meetings. Instead, this family celebrates the Father's goodness, grows in his transforming affection, and is learning to embrace each other and the world with the same love that Jesus demonstrated when he was among us. Chapter 3, then, what then is the church? And maybe I'll record that one for you sometime. Hope you don't mind if this is not of interest to you. Obviously, you don't have to listen to them, but for those of you, I've got a lot of feedback from the first chapter and people wanting to engage some of that. I know it creates the desire. I wish I could read it tomorrow, and I wish you could too. I can't wait to be done with it, but we'll see. It'll be done when it's done, and I'll keep slugging away at it here once I get back from Israel and hopefully get these last few chapters kind of nailed down. I'm excited, honestly. I tell you, for myself, writing this book has allowed me to bring into focus things that I've carried in my heart, some of them for 40 years, some of them only in the last year or two, and some of them are emerging in the writing. I'm seeing things more clearly, and in the conversations I'm having, I don't write stuff that I'm not in conversations with people about, and I don't mean select people. I just, wherever I'm with. Including this pastor I was with last week, and he's asking about the content. And I'm interacting because I believe that the wider confirmation of what's true doesn't come through one or two people who are gifted to write or speak or whatever. It comes through the collective wisdom that God makes available in the body of Christ. And I'm excited about a better definition of church, which even in this community it's not to me the people who don't sit in buildings on Sunday mornings, because some of it does. And I enjoy engaging those people as much as I enjoy people who now are no longer part of it, but are finding a significant journey in Jesus that has gone past that conformity stuff. It's a great journey. I'm loving it. I'm sure I'm enjoying Israel at the moment. And we'll bring some of that to you when I get back. Don't expect the podcast next week. It's not going to happen. So I guess we'll continue this conversation at least for the next couple of weeks on the blog at thegodjourney.com.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com. Thank you.